I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
This is the second part of our Unearthed for the End of 2023. And today we are going to be talking about the shipwrecks and the art and just so many things that are about animals. As is often the case, we will be starting off with some things that didn't really fit into categories, which I always call the potpourri. And if you are a regular listener to Unearthed, you might be thinking, normally there's repatriation somewhere on the list. We aren't talking about them this time, and we will talk about why that is in the behind the scenes on Friday.
So on to potpourri. Renovations work at St. George's Guildhall in King's Lynn has unearthed floorboards dating back to the 15th century, meaning that they likely would have been in place when William Shakespeare is believed to have performed there in 1592 or 1593. This is based on an account book from those years, which shows the Earl of Pembroke's men being paid to perform in King's Lynn while the London theaters were closed because of plague. The Earl of Pembroke's men performed some of Shakespeare's plays, but it's not conclusively established whether he was with them at that time.
So these boards were dated using tree ring analysis, and if that dating is correct, this may be the only surviving 15th century timber floor in all of England. A replacement floor had been installed over those original floorboards about 75 years ago. St. George's Guildhall is the oldest working theater in England, so even if Shakespeare himself did not actually perform on that original floor, the theater still has its own historic importance.
Also, in one of the funniest quotes in the research for this installment of Unearthed, Michael Dobson, director of the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon, told The Times, quote, "I don't think it's hugely important unless you're a kind of fetishist who really thinks that having a piece of wood that has probably been touched by Shakespeare's foot is going to make an enormous difference to your understanding of the plays, which I rather doubt."
I read that and I laughed out loud.
I love him for this because it was my almost exact reaction when I heard this story.
Yeah.
I'm like, why though? Why?
It's like kind of a cool little bit of trivia if Shakespeare did perform on this exact floor, but we don't actually know for sure. And also, does it matter? Anyway, next. Archaeologists in northern Spain have found a Roman-era sandal in a well, presumably lost by somebody who was cleaning that well about 2,000 years ago. I can think of some other scenarios that would wind up with a sandal in the well, but like every article about this says somebody was cleaning it. This is one of only about 20 sandals that have been found from what was Roman Hispania. And in addition to that, it's really heavily decorated with this pattern of circles and ovals and other shapes. Like, when I first saw a picture of it, I was like, is this the soul of a modern shoe? Like, I had a moment where I doubted what I was looking at. Because there was no oxygen at the bottom of the well, this sandal is very well preserved, and it was frozen so it could be, you know, preserved in that state until it could go for actual cleaning and preservation. Once all of that's done, it is planned to be exhibited at the Archaeological Museum of Asturias.
Potpourri is brief this time. This is our last bit. Researchers have determined that a piece of iron found in a gravesite in Bavaria in 2017 was a prosthetic hand. Archaeologists concluded that the person buried at this site was a man between the ages of 30 and 50, and based on radiocarbon dating, he died sometime between 1450 and 1620. X-rays of his arm and hand suggest that his fingers may have been amputated, and the bones of his thumb were still present.
So this prosthesis had four slightly curved, immobile fingers. They were each made from sheet metal. And there were remnants of a gauze-like fabric that suggested there was cushioning on the inside of it. This prosthesis was probably secured to his arm using straps, although the straps haven't survived. This is one of about 50 prostheses that have been found in Central Europe, dating back to the medieval and early modern period. And some of them, like this one, were sort of an immobile piece, but others were articulated and had various mechanical elements that could let a person do things like move the prosthetic fingers and hold objects with them.
It's time for art, my favorite. A room that has recently opened to the public at the Basilica of San Lorenzo in Florence, Italy, is believed to be where Michelangelo hid after being sentenced to death by Pope Clement VII. The Pope was part of the Medici family, which had been in control of Florence until being overthrown in a populist revolt in 1537. After the Medici's return to power, the Pope sentenced Michelangelo to death because he had worked for the Republican government that had briefly displaced the Medici's. Michelangelo was in hiding for about 2 months until the Pope lifted that death sentence.
So this basilica is part of the Museum of the Medici Chapels, and the space known as the Stanza Segreta, or the secret room, was discovered there in 1975. A restorer had been assigned to clean part of the walls with the hope that this space could be used to make a new visitor's entrance to the basilica. But it turned out that under the layers of plaster, the walls were just covered in sketches, and those sketches are believed to have been drawn by Michelangelo, although it is not conclusively proven that he is the person who drew them.
This is a very small, narrow room, mostly built below street level, with only one small window. While it is open to the public, access is very limited. Only four visitors are allowed in at a time, can only stay for 15 minutes, and then there's a 45-minute break to reduce how much the space is exposed to light. So that means that only about 100 visitors can see this space each week.
Next, according to research published in the Cambridge Archaeological Journal, an object shown in the painting Etienne Chevalier with St. Stephen by Jean Fouquet may be a prehistoric hand axe. This painting is part of the Melun Diptych. It was commissioned by Etienne Chevalier, and it depicts him with his hands folded in prayer next to his patron saint. His patron saint is holding a copy of the New Testament with this object resting on the top of it. This object has usually, before now, been described as just something like a jagged stone. But Stephen Kangas, lecturer in the Department of Art History at Dartmouth, had for a long time thought it resembled a hand axe.
He eventually discussed this with other professors, and they collaborated with colleagues at the University of Cambridge to analyze the object's shape, color, and flake scars, comparing that to stone tools known as Acheulean hand axes. Those were common about 500,000 years ago. They found that its shape and flake scars were similar to hand axes used in the region where the image was painted. Color was a little harder to determine since pigments and varnishes used on the painting may not reflect the real object, but the amount of color variation in the image suggests that the artist was recreating the details of a real stone object.
So for centuries, hand axes and other flaked or ground prehistoric objects have been a source of fascination and study. Although centuries ago, people did not really have a sense of exactly what these were or how old they were. In Europe, this included folklore around the idea that these were thunderstones created in the sky by lightning strikes. The first written record of the term thunderstones, describing what was probably a prehistoric hand axe, dates back to the mid-1500s. This painting, though, was made in about 1455, so if it really does depict a hand axe, this kind of pushes back the social history of these hand axes in Europe by about 100 years.
I want to develop a whole Thor theory around this, but that's just me.
Sure.
In our last art find, the UK National Trust restored four paintings by Joshua Reynolds in commemoration of the 300th anniversary of his birth. And in his painting, The Death of Cardinal Beaufort, painted in 1789, they uncovered a demon-like figure that had at some point been painted over.
So this painting depicts a scene from Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 2, in which the king, at the cardinal's deathbed, says, quote, "Oh, beat away the busy meddling fiend that lays strong siege unto this wretch's soul, and from his bosom purge this black despair." So this is read as something that was going on within the cardinal's inner world, but Reynolds painted an actual fiend peering out from behind a curtain. This was incredibly controversial when the painting was first shown at the Shakespeare Gallery, which had also commissioned it. Basically, a lot of people thought Shakespeare's words had been figurative or metaphorical, and that Reynolds should have stuck with that, having, you know, the metaphorical anguish on his face rather than depicting an actual devil in the painting.
I love this literalist reading.
There's so much drama about this fiend in the painting.
So the fiend was ultimately painted over, and there was also an attempt to remove it from the printing plate for a second run of prints in 1792 after Reynolds had died. Removing the layers of paint and varnish obscuring the fiend took restorers about 6 months.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Reynolds was pressured into painting it over or if somebody else did it after he died. That was not clear to me from the reporting on this. But anyway, that's the last of the art, and we will take a quick break and come back for animals. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/Papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Now we have some animals. In fact, many animals. This whole section of the episode is just going to be animals. According to research published in the journal Environmental Archaeology, ancient Egypt may have had more types of venomous snakes than it does today. This came from an analysis of a medical treatise known as the Brooklyn Papyrus, which dates back to sometime between 660 and 330 BCE. It is called the Brooklyn Papyrus because it was donated to the Brooklyn Museum in the 1930s. It lists 37 different species of venomous snakes, although the descriptions of 13 of those have been lost. But modern Egypt has fewer venomous snake species than that. There are 8 species that are capable of causing significant envenoming if they bite something, and then a few others can cause minor envenoming.
One of the snakes was described as the great snake of Apophis, Apophis being a deity that took the form of a serpent. This snake is described as having 4 fangs, which is not the case for any snake currently living in Egypt. The snake living closest to modern Egypt that does have 4 fangs is the boomslang, which lives farther south in Africa. Its range starts about 400 miles or 650 kilometers south of modern Egypt.
So the basic idea here is that snakes that currently live in tropical Africa, including the boomslang, may have been able to live in ancient Egypt, which was wetter and more humid than Egypt is today. The team identified snakes that could plausibly have lived in this environment from thousands of years ago, and then they used niche modeling, which is also known as species distribution modeling, to try to predict where 10 identified snake species might have lived around 4,000 years ago. And then they also tested proposed identifications for some of the species that were described in the papyrus.
According to their modeling, 9 of the 10 snakes that they examined could have lived in ancient Egypt thousands of years ago. This was likeliest in the more southern and southeastern parts of the region and along the Nile Valley and the Red Sea coast. This included the boomslang and the puff adder, both of which align with descriptions of snakes from the Brooklyn Papyrus.
And speaking of snakes in Egypt, archaeologists in Egypt have also found a burial chamber belonging to a scribe that was adorned with spells that were meant to ward off snake bites. So this chamber is roughly 2,500 years old. It belonged to a royal scribe who died at the age of about 25. And these inscriptions, which are on the north wall, both describe the snakes as protectors of the deceased and serve to protect his mummy from bites. So I don't know if these were literal or figurative snakes, but they were there to protect him, but also they wanted to make sure that the snakes did not bite his mummy.
This is, they wanted to keep Indiana Jones out, is what it was. Now we've got some studies about beavers. Beavers became extinct in the Netherlands in the 19th century and then were reintroduced in 1988. And their population has been growing there in recent years. And according to research published in the Holocene, beavers were a key part of the diets of prehistoric people in the Netherlands, as well as other parts of Northern Europe. They also played a major role in the ecosystems where they lived. According to this research, beavers were one of the most common mammals found at archaeological sites of hunter-gatherer communities in the Netherlands.
So in addition to using beavers for their meat and their pelts and teeth and bones, and for the glandular substance known as castoreum, Mesolithic hunter-gatherer peoples also benefited from the landscapes that beavers created with their lodges and dams. When the beavers dam a water source, the resulting landscape is often home to other animals, including an abundance of fish and otters and waterfowl. It is possible, according to this research, that people specifically sought out places where beavers were living when they were deciding where to make their homes.
And we have another beaver find. Research in eastern Germany also shows that people were hunting beavers much earlier than previously thought, as long as 400,000 years ago. This comes from the careful examination of the remains of 94 beavers, using magnifying glasses and digital microscopes to look for evidence that they had been cut with stone tools. They found that most of the ones that showed evidence of cut marks were young adults, suggesting that they were fully grown but not particularly experienced animals.
The paper didn't say this, but I read it as being that they were not as adept at staying out of people's way.
Right. They had not developed their savvy yet.
Right. We have talked on previous installments of Unearthed about the assumption that ancient hunter-gatherers mostly hunted really large animals, the idea being that smaller animals like beaver just would not provide enough resources to be worth the effort of hunting them. But the researchers involved with this project suggested a different possibility, which is that the bones of larger animals from this far back in history are just usually better preserved than those of smaller animals, making it easier to find them and study them and see evidence of their being cut or processed by humans.
Next, according to research published in the journal Antiquity, researchers have found the oldest known use of shark teeth in composite weapons. These are two weapons with blades made from the teeth of tiger sharks found on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi. They're about 7,000 years old, which is 2,000 years older than the previous oldest known shark tooth knives. These teeth were affixed to a handle using a glue-like substance and plant fibers, which is still a technique used by people living in parts of the Pacific.
These teeth showed evidence of having been used to pierce and cut flesh and bone, but according to the researchers, it was unlikely that these knives were for everyday purposes. Shark teeth get dull very quickly. Living sharks are just continually growing new teeth. So it is more likely that these knives were used maybe for ritual purposes or in some kind of combat, not something that you would have just cut your food with every day.
I'm literally picturing like a teenager of this era making it and going, doesn't this look cool? Like there's no real use. Next, a couple of different teams have looked at baboons in ancient Egypt. While baboons do not live in Egypt today, and there's no evidence to suggest that they did so in the past, baboons were brought to Egypt from elsewhere, kept in captivity, and mummified after their deaths.
Research published in the journal eLife tried to pin down exactly where these baboons came from. They compared the mitochondrial DNA of mummified baboons to the DNA of modern baboons, as well as to DNA from 100 to 150-year-old baboon specimens in museum collections.
One of the collaborators on this paper had previously identified the general region of the Horn of Africa as where most of these animals had been born and had lived during their early years. We talked about this on an episode of Unearthed in 2020. This year's research narrowed the area further to a specific part of Eritrea and neighboring regions. This area was home to the ancient port of Adulis.
As we mentioned in that 2020 installment of Unearthed, this overlaps with research into the exact location of the kingdom of Punt, something that we also talked about in our episode on Hatshepsut's expeditions to Punt, which came out in 2019. The baboons were described as having come from Punt, so it is possible that Punt was an earlier name for that same ancient port.
The other baboon research published late last year looked at the living conditions of these animals while they were kept in captivity in Egypt. Egyptians held these animals in very high regard, and they were believed to be representations of the god Thoth. But they weren't actually treated very well, or at least given the kind of treatment they needed to be healthy. This research looked at the mummies of 36 baboons, which lived between 800 and 500 BCE, and found that many of them had signs of rickets, or a deficiency of vitamin D, probably because of being kept indoors and away from natural sunlight. Otherwise, they didn't show evidence of being abused or mistreated, but only four of the mummies they studied were those of animals who seemed to be in actual good health.
Researchers who were interviewed about this work stressed that they didn't think the people who cared for these animals meant them any harm. But since baboons are very good climbers, if you wanted to keep them in captivity, they had to be in enclosures that had very high walls, and these would have blocked out most of the sunlight.
Archaeologists in China have found evidence of a chariot in Shanxi province, one that would have been drawn by sheep rather than the more commonly used horses or oxen. The body of the chariot has not survived until today, but the rigging used to pull it was still evident on the bones of the sheep. This chariot was found in the mausoleum of an emperor who ruled between 221 to 210 BCE, which was hundreds of years before the first written mention of a sheep-drawn chariot. That appears in an account of Emperor Sima Yan of the Western Jin Dynasty, who lived from 265 to 316 and is said to have ridden a sheep-drawn chariot to the palace every night before going to sleep.
Moving on, archaeologists also believe they have found the oldest true saddle in East Asia, one that involved a wooden frame covered in horsehide with a pommel, a cantle, and stirrups, as well as various straps. This dates back to around the 4th century, meaning it's also one of the earliest known frame saddles in the world. This suggests that cultures living on the steppes of Western and Northern Mongolia, where the saddle was found, were early adopters of both frame saddles and stirrups and helped spread these technologies to other parts of the world.
And in our last animal find, Coast Salish people and researchers from the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History have worked to study the pelt of a dog named Mutton, who was donated to the Smithsonian by naturalist and ethnographer George Gibbs after the dog died in 1859. Mutton was a woolly dog, which was a type of dog that Coast Salish nations bred and cared for thousands of years, but which had died out by the turn of the 20th century. Woolly dogs had a very thick pelt, and they were sheared like sheep, and Mutton's pelt is the only known woolly dog fleece left in the world. This wool was used to make things like blankets and other woven items, some of which were used for ceremonial and spiritual purposes.
This project included the work of anthropologists, an evolutionary molecular biologist, and elders, knowledge keepers, and master weavers from Coast Salish nations, who provided the context for how these dogs lived in Coast Salish societies. In the words of anthropologist Logan Kistler, the museum's curator of archaeobotany and archaeogenomics, quote, Coast Salish traditional perspective was the entire context for understanding the study's findings.
Michael Pavel, an elder from the Skokomish-Twana Coast Salish community in Washington, said, quote, "We were very excited to participate in a study that embraces the most sophisticated Western science with the most established traditional knowledge. It was incredibly rewarding to contribute to this effort to embrace and celebrate our understanding of the woolly dog." Many of the Coast Salish people who were part of this work were cited in the paper as co-authors, and the text of the interviews conducted with Coast Salish people is included in the paper's supplemental materials.
Researchers also compared mutton's DNA to that of other dogs to try to determine what made the woolly dog's coat so different and when this breed split off from other dogs. They found that this likely happened at least 5,000 years ago. And Coast Salish people continued to carefully breed these dogs long after other dogs were introduced to the area. At least 85% of mutton's genetic ancestry came from pre-colonial dogs.
The researchers' work with Coast Salish people also contradicted earlier assumptions about what caused the populations of these dogs to decline. Scholars had generally concluded that the introduction of machine-made blankets into the region in the 19th century meant that the dogs were no longer seen as a priority. But indigenous experts cited other factors, including the introduction of diseases, forced assimilation, and genocide that caused indigenous populations to decline, along with other external factors that made it increasingly difficult for Coast Salish people to care for these dogs. Essentially, the indigenous people who were interviewed as part of this research made it clear that the dogs were too important to their communities to have just been forgotten about because of machine-made blankets.
And that is the last of our animal finds this time. And we will take a quick sponsor break before we move on to shipwrecks. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road trip or waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
It is time for a number of shipwrecks. A 4th century shipwreck discovered off the coast of Sicily in 2020 was named the Mariusa II because of its similarity to another shipwreck by the same name that had been found not far away in 1999. Last year, this second ship was raised up from the seabed intact, something that was possible because it was both very well preserved and was only in about 6 feet or 1.8 meters of water. After underwater archaeologists documented this site, the wreck was basically surrounded in a cage and then secured with nets, lifted from the seafloor with flotation devices, and towed to shore. From there, it was transported by road to an archaeological museum for desalination and study. So the research on this one is ongoing. I just find making a big cage to lift a shipwreck up off the ocean floor, I found the whole process of that fascinating. I know it's not the only time we've raised a ship off the ocean floor,
but it is interesting.
Yeah, but for one dating back to the 4th century, like what a delicate thing to need to try to raise up.
Yes. This past summer, a team conducting sonar scans in Lake Superior found the wreck of a freighter called the Huronton, announcing the find in October for the 100th anniversary of its sinking. The Huronton collided with the Cetus on October 11th, 1923, when Lake Superior was under a heavy fog, and visibility was obscured even further because of smoke from wildfires. The Cetus hit the Huronton on its port side, and the captain of the Cetus basically used the ship to plug the hole to give the Huronton's crew time to escape, including a bulldog who was serving as the ship's mascot, who at first was accidentally left behind. But no worries about the dog, the first mate went back for him before the ship sank.
This wreck is one of so many in Lake Superior, and it was found during a systemic search of the lake bed for undiscovered wrecks. Thousands of vessels sank in the lake, especially during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and a lot of them are now being threatened by mussels, especially zebra mussels and quagga mussels. There is ongoing work to just try to find and document as many of these as possible before they are lost to these and other factors.
Speaking of the Great Lakes, a father and daughter fishing in Green Bay, Wisconsin on Lake Michigan spotted a shipwreck on their sonar, and that may be the remains of the George L. Newman. The George L. Newman sank during the Great Peshtigo Fire, which prior hosts of the show talked about in a 2011 episode called History's Unforgettable Fires. The ship ran aground because visibility was so poor due to the smoke that they could not see where they were going. The crew were rescued by a nearby lighthouse keeper. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources used a remote-operated vehicle to take pictures of the wreck, and further research is expected in the spring.
Next, a crew with the Florida Department of Transportation found a shipwreck while working on a drainage improvement project in St. Augustine. This was found more than 8 feet underground and probably dates back to the mid to late 19th century. The ship's stern had been exposed at some point and was probably consumed by marine life, but the rest of the boat, which is believed to have been a single-masted fishing vessel, is mostly intact. It's possible that the boat was abandoned along the edge of a waterway that has since been covered up by landfill. This wreck was taken to wet storage for preservation and further study.
Moving on, the San Jose has come up on a few installments of Unearthed. This is a galleon that the British sunk off the coast of Cartagena in 1708. Its discovery was announced in 2015, which led to a dispute about who owned the enormous amount of gold and other valuable goods that it was carrying. It was a Spanish ship found off the coast of Colombia, and many of the precious metals aboard were mined by indigenous peoples. On top of all of that, a U.S. salvage company claims to have originally found the wreck back in 1981.
In the latest update on this, President Gustavo Petro has ordered his administration to begin recovering the wreck's cargo in April or May, depending on sea conditions, intending to remove as much of it as possible from the wreck before his term in office ends in 2026. So this has, of course, added another layer of controversy to the ship, with some archaeologists arguing that it should be treated as an archaeological site, not as cargo to be retrieved.
This past spring, we talked about the discovery of a shipwreck in Newport, Wales. This was found in the River Usk back in 2002, and when we talked about it last year, it was being conserved with plans to eventually reassemble it and make it a public attraction. Now, study of the ship's timbers have pinpointed that it was built from trees that were cut down over the winter of 1457 to 1458.
Yes, this is sort of narrowing down exactly when it was built and hopefully eventually learning more about the exact ship that it was. Next, the wreck of the SS Dix has been found in Puget Sound in Washington. The Dix was working as a ferry, part of a collection of privately owned vessels known as the Mosquito Fleet that operated in the area for about a century. Obviously, there are still lots of ferries in the Seattle area, but this was before a lot of the roads and bridges that connect various islands were there. There were a lot more ferries operating. The Dix was taking passengers from Seattle to Bainbridge Island when it sank in 1906 after colliding with the SS Jeannie. At least 42 passengers died, making it one of Seattle's worst maritime disasters. This wreck was apparently found all the way back in 2015, but not announced until now.
Experts working with the 17th century Swedish warship Vasa have said it urgently needs a new structural support system. The wreck was raised from the Baltic Sea in 1961, and it's been displayed at the Vasa Museum in Stockholm since 1990. But the existing steel cradle is putting uneven pressure on parts of the ship, and the ship itself is deteriorating due to the effects of pollution it absorbed from the water while it was still submerged. This is something the museum has been studying and working on for years, and now it has reached the point that it has to raise the funds to pay for it. The Vasa Museum is self-funded, and the estimated cost of a new support structure is 150 million kroner.
And we will close out our shipwrecks with a few items that came from wrecks, not the wrecks themselves. A steamship called the St. Lucie sank off the coast of Miami on October 18, 1906, during a hurricane. That ship was eventually raised from the seafloor, repaired, and put back into use. But researchers announced the discovery of its anchor in November. Maritime archaeologist Joshua Morano had been showing two summer interns around Biscayne National Park when he noticed a sea turtle behaving strangely and then saw it sitting underneath this anchor.
This is an anchor, so of course it is extremely heavy. The cost of removing and restoring it would be significant, so the current plan is to leave it in place, but hopefully to eventually make a 3D rendering of it.
Next, archaeologists working off the coast of Capri, Italy, have found several pieces of worked obsidian that were probably used as trade materials. They are believed to have come from a lost Neolithic cargo vessel, so they're incredibly old. There's no evidence of the wreck itself found so far, and honestly, at this point, probably would not be. It is also possible that this may have come not from a cargo vessel, but from a Neolithic coastal settlement that was eventually submerged. Of course, no evidence of that settlement has been found either.
And lastly, one of the artifacts that was recovered from the wreck of a cog in Estonia in 2022 has turned out to be the oldest functioning dry compass in Europe. We talked about the discovery of the cog on Unearthed, and at the time, it wasn't clear what the wreck's fate would be. It was excavated, and the wreck was moved to the Estonian Maritime Museum. The compass is one of the items to have been found during the cleaning and conservation process. They have also found things like tools, weapons, and shoes.
And to finish up our unearthed from 2023, we have two baths, both of them found under something else. First, archaeologists in Bath, England, have unearthed a cold bath, one that was documented in the historical record but had not been located yet. This was in a suite of three rooms under one end of the ballroom at Bath Assembly Rooms. Those rooms were completed in 1771, and then at some point after that, the bath was covered over with a floor. So excavating this bath involved removing that floor and just a huge amount of rubble underneath it.
When Bath came up on the show earlier in 2023 in our episodes on Dean Muhammad, we were talking mostly about steam baths and warm water baths. But cold baths and cold plunges were recommended for people's health as well. Most of them were built at people's private homes or in public facilities devoted to bathing and wellness. This is the first cold bath known to have been built at an assembly room.
And the other bath is a Roman bath found under the Split City Museum in Split, Croatia. The museum is housed in what was once a palace, and centuries before it had been the site of Diocletian's palace, built for the Roman Emperor Diocletian in the 3rd century. Diocletian's palace is still part of much of Split's old city core today. This bath featured mosaic floors with an underfloor heating system and a furnace, and there was also an oil and grape press.
These baths were discovered during repairs that were part of a project called Palace of Life, City of Change, which is a development and restoration project for the central city and the site of Diocletian's palace. The hope is to open at least part of the bath to the public once it's clear that the building's structural integrity will make it safe to do so.
And that is the end of our 2023. I was going to say 2024, but that's where we are now. 2023 Unearthed. And I have just one little bit of listener mail. It is from Katie. And Katie said, "Hi, Holly and Tracy. I have a lot of thoughts about your discussion of math in this week's Behind the Scenes, but none of them are about Tracy perpetuating gendered math stereotypes. I was an elementary school teacher for several years, and now I'm a mom. So I see what my kids are learning math-wise. In college, I had to take a class about how math works meant for educators. Part of the class involved relearning basic operations in a base other than 10. So we were adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing in base 7. The idea was that it would help us remember how difficult it can be for young kids to learn math. The math programs I used to teach and the ones my kids have been using all teach both customary and metric measures, but then it seems after the introduction, they mostly stick with customary measures moving forward. Finally, the complaints of parents about the new math annoyed me as a teacher and a parent, but over the years, I've seen schools address it more. Some schools hold seminars for parents to teach them the methods their kids are learning. Some homework has examples at the top. And many math programs have an online video component that shows you how to do it. Of course, the easiest way to keep parents from complaining is just to get rid of homework, especially in elementary school, where there isn't much evidence for its usefulness. Thanks for all your hard work on the podcast. Katie, P.S., here's our cat, Stella, in a moment where she wasn't knocking over our Christmas tree and our dog, Arya, confused about the shirt he had to wear post-lumpectomy. I love both of these pictures. What adorable dog and cat. Boy, do I love not having homework in elementary school. That was the age I got in the most trouble for not doing my homework because I thought it was a waste of my time. It is, as Katie said in this email, there's just an increasing body of evidence that, like, homework in elementary school does not help children learn more.
Right.
And if anything, the only homework that should be happening is like classwork that wasn't finished in class.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's I'm not a teacher and I'm not a parent, but it seems like kids should get to be kids.
Yeah.
I was like great about my homework because I whipped that stuff out on the bus. It never got opened in the house.
Yeah, when I got to high school, I was big on the doing homework on the bus, which was only possible because I found a weird seating position where I was wedged into the bus seat that allowed me to do my homework on the bus without getting motion sick. Because if I try to read in the car, instant motion sickness. Bus doesn't move quite the same as a car. And I also just, I found this really weird way to sit that's like supported my head on the back of the bus seat. And that is where I did overwhelmingly, especially math homework, always on the bus. So, thank you so much for that email. If you'd like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. We're all over social media at Missed in History, and you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app and wherever else you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.